But Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel. I want to welcome you to part four, the concluding part of this wonderful series of archaeology, the Second Temple period. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Shuli to continue with her pictures and her insight into this important period in Jewish history. Vakasha, Shuli, let's go. It's all yours.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Happy Tu B'Shvat. We're done here, but you guys are still, people in Chutz La'aretz are still going. You still have a little time to go out and, you know, plant a tree virtually or in real life. So we are going to get started. We are on, like Rabbi Kalman mentioned, this is the last of the four. And it's sad, first of all, because it's the last, and I happen to think this is one of the most fascinating periods in Jewish history. And it's also sad because this is the ending is a terrible ending. And that, of course, is the story of the breakdown of the peace with Rome that we had, relative peace, let's say, not necessarily best friends, but relative peace, relative stability. Since the time of Herod breaks down in the 60s of the first century, and we have the Great Revolt, which culminates, of course, with the destruction of the Second Temple, with exile from Jerusalem, terrible, terrible tragedy in which the Jewish nation does manage to rebuild itself, but without a temple. And that's the post-Korban period is a fascinating time as well. When we talk about the Great Revolt, usually we focus on Jerusalem, we focus on the Mikdash, on the temple, or we tell the story of Masada, which is the dramatic ending of the revolt. But I want to go in a different direction this time, and we're going to talk about the Great Revolt in the north, partly because it's the very beginning, right? The beginning of the story is really in the Galilee. That's where the major battles happen, and it's all over, right? Starts in 66, it's over in 67, and at that point, the Romans focus on Jerusalem. So it's really the beginning of the story, but it's also the beginning in the sense of it's a very popular, at this point in time, the revolt is a very popular uprising. Many, many people are involved. The people of the Galilee in general are involved. So that's why I really wanted to focus here on these lesser known sites. We're going to be talking about the Galilee in general and the revolt in general, but we're going to be zeroing in on two particular places. One is Yodfat, right? And Yodfat, which is the picture that you see here. Recently, the Parks Authority added in a few accessories to help you imagine the scene better in Yodfat. And these, of course, are the Roman shields and the Roman spears, copies, recreations of them. So we're going to talk about Yodfat and we're going to talk about Gamla, each of them interesting and unique in its own way. Yodfat is very special, not because so much was found there, even though there are very interesting things that were found there, but because our historian Josephus, who we're going to explore a little bit, he is the commander in Yodfat. And so what he writes, he's writing from an eyewitness perspective. And Gamla, because Gamla is the end, and Gamla is an incredibly dramatic story, both the defeat as well as the rediscovery centuries and centuries later. So let's get started, okay? Let's understand where we are, okay? So we are, like I said, we're in the north, we're in the Galilee, okay? We're going to be talking about, not about the monkey forest, sorry, but we are going to be talking about Yodfat, which is really squarely in the center of the Upper Galilee. Today, it's considered kind of a remote, off the beaten track sort of place, but it definitely isn't, right? It's smack in the middle between the Mediterranean and the Kinneret. It's in the center of a lot of smaller and larger Jewish communities. Okay, so we're going to talk about Yodfat and we're going to talk about Gamla, which is not written on my map, but it's right here, right in the northeastern corner above the Kinneret. So those are the two places we're going to talk about. In general, the Galil, right, the Galilee, somewhat different than the land of Judah. We have references to that in various places in the Gemara, as well as in Josephus, as well as in the New Testament, where a lot of the participants are from the Galilee, are from the Galil. Some of the differences we hear about are halachic. Some of the differences we hear about are ideological. The Galilee seems to be a place that, on the one hand, they know less Hebrew. Okay, more Aramaic, more Greek, certainly from the later synagogue inscriptions that we find, but also just from the Gemara talks about how the people of Judah, the people of Judah kept their language and the people of the Galil did not keep their language, of course, being Hebrew. Okay? in the period we're talking about in Second Temple times, the weight of scholarship is in Jerusalem and not in the Galilee, but it doesn't mean that there weren't people who didn't know things. But we don't hear about, for example, sectarianism in the Galilee. Okay? We don't hear about a lot of these ideological fights that we hear about in Jerusalem, which leads some people to suggest that maybe these are the simpler, these are the pshutei am. Not necessarily, right? Not necessarily. They seem to be more modest. They seem to have, in some ways, better values, right? The Gemara talks about how in Eretz Yehuda, in the land of Judah, couples would move in, right? Before they were married, they would move in together. Sounds very shocking to us, right? But they would do that. Whereas in the Galilee, they were much more modest. They didn't do that. In Yehuda, they would not guarantee the rights in the ketubah for a widow after her husband dies. They wouldn't give her, you know, unlimited food until she marries or remarries or she dies. Whereas in the Galilee, they would do that. So we definitely have some differences. They are not as close to the temple. They do not see Jerusalem in the temple as often. But as we're going to see, they are very, very connected to the temple. So we're going to stay up here in the Galil. We're also going to talk a little about the causes of the revolt. Now, like I said, Herod holds off the Romans, the what's going to be an inevitable conflict with the Romans, but he manages to hold it off for a century. And he manages to make the land of Israel part of the Pax Romana. We do not openly engage in battles with the Romans, even though there's plenty of tension. The governors that come after Herod, the procurators, are venal and greedy people who collect as much tax money as they possibly can. But the tensions are simmering underneath the surface, and they only really burst out in the 60s of the first century. Now, the tensions are both internal and external. Internal, we've been talking about for the past three classes, right? Internal tensions, take a look at the picture on the left, right? We have our jars of the scrolls from the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have the sectarian religious issues that are simmering underneath the surface. We have economic issues. That's the picture on the right, right? This beautiful mosaic carpet from the mansions in the Herodian Quarter in Jerusalem. You have these very wealthy, and in some cases wealthy because of corruption, priests in Jerusalem. You have people who are much poorer. Just to give you an idea of how this is part of the whole story of the revolt, you could say, "Ah, oh, this is an internal Jewish thing. It has nothing to do with it." When the Zealots take over in Jerusalem, they burn the debt records, right? The records of Jews that owe money to other Jews, right? So there's this socioeconomic tension simmering under the surface. And there's also the tension of how you deal with the Romans, right? We have pacifists and we have the Zealots. We see those reflected in our sources, right? Pirkei Avot. You have to be very careful of the malchut key, because if you don't have it, ishet re'ehu chayim bla'o, there's going to be anarchy. And then there are others who say, well, if this is the government that we have, perhaps we prefer anarchy. So we have all kinds of internal tensions simmering underneath the surface. And we have plenty of external tensions as well. And that, of course, is because of this very large Roman Empire that you can see here, which, by the way, and this is going to be important to us to understand when we talk about the Roman reaction to the revolt, take a look at where we are, Judea, okay? The orange is the Roman Empire. We are at the very edge, right? The eastern border of the empire. On the other side of the border are these guys called the Parthians, sworn enemies of the Romans. So when the Romans come and react as they do in the Great Revolt and attack the Jews, it's not only because they don't like the Jews. They don't like the Jews. Okay, who likes Jews? But they are also doing it because they know that this is a border area. And if we fall, it could be dominoes, right? And the Parthians could move in and take over more areas of the Roman Empire. So that's important to keep in mind just in terms of a military political issue. The Roman Empire is not exactly wonderful to the Jews. Lots of taxes. the procurators collect as much taxes as they can, right? Who's the person who is most hated in the ancient world? The tax collector, right? Or the tax farmer, because what you would do is you had to give a certain amount to the government, but whatever you collected over that amount goes to you. So it's obviously in your best interests to get as much as you can. So very high taxes, not very much security. The Jews don't get much. The non-Jews get much more. So those are the very practical things, but you also have ideological. First of all, Jews see themselves, as always, as the chosen people. And if we're the chosen people, right, maybe you should choose someone else for a while, as Tevye says, right? How can the Romans treat us in this way? How can the Romans be in such a superior position and we are in such an inferior position? And not only in the secular world, even in the Mikdash, even in the temple, the Romans control who is the high priest, who is the Kohen Gadol. They have a large part in taking money from the Jews, right? Add to this the terrible humiliation of what happens to Jews who are traitors, right? Crucifixion obviously does not happen only to Jesus, right? It happens to many, many people who speak out against the Roman Empire. So you have humiliation, you have this feeling that we should be in a different place than where we are. We have practical concerns. One of the things we don't have, and it's fascinating because we do have it 65 years later in the Bar Kokhba revolt, we don't hear about religious persecution, meaning the Romans think we're strange, but they don't have what the Gemara calls gezeirot hashmad, right? Religious decrees. We don't really hear about that in the Great Revolt. And maybe a little bit of images here and there, but they don't stop Jews from doing things like Shabbat or Brit Milah or learning Torah. So we're not talking about religious persecution unless, if you're a zealot, right, if you're one of the guys fighting against the Romans, you see the very fact of serving the Romans as religious persecution because you see that as a form of idolatry. But other than that, we don't really hear about that. So we have internal tensions, external tensions leading to the breakout of the revolt. Who are on the Roman side of the equation? Okay, so when the revolt begins, first of all, just to give us a little bit of background, the year 64, we have the Great Fire of Rome. And so we know who is the Emperor Nero, right? Nero's fiddling while Rome is burning. Nero is a rather dysfunctional emperor. Eventually, he commits suicide. The first general who is sent in to fight, Vespasian, is called back to Rome, and he becomes the new emperor, the new dynasty, right? The Flavian dynasty. And his son Titus takes over, and he's eventually the one who actually conquers Jerusalem. Vespasian begins the attack, but Titus is the one who conquers Jerusalem. So that's just to give us a little background of our Romans, and of course the Romans much better than the Jews in figurative representation, certainly at this time period. So we know what Vespasian looked like, or at least an idealized version. We know what Titus looked like. So here they are, the Flavian emperors. And another one of our characters who's going to be very important is Josephus. Now, we rely on Josephus an awful lot. Okay? Josephus writes a number of books. Most important for our story today is a book called The Jewish War, or The Wars of the Jews, right? Bellus Judaicus. And the question is, how much can we trust him? Right. He also writes a book called Antiquity. He writes an autobiography. So what's his story? Who is he? What do we know about him? And again, can we trust him? So we know he tells us in his autobiography, he is a Kohen. Okay, his name is Yosef ben Matityahu, Flavius. He becomes Josephus Flavius eventually. He takes on the name of his Roman patrons, the Roman emperors, the Flavian dynasty that we talked about. Okay? He's born as a Kohen in Jerusalem. He takes pains to tell us that he's one of the most important Kohen families in Jerusalem. His mother is connected to the Hasmoneans. So presumably he's also wealthy as well as well-connected. He spends some time as a teenager down in the Judean desert with the ascetic sects, okay, with the Essenes perhaps, or someone else. Sorry, I just have something annoying on my screen, but I can't seem to get rid of it. You guys don't see it, I assume, so I'm not worrying about that. He then goes off to Rome. He intercedes to release prisoners. He's still a very young man, right? And he takes part in all these things as a very young man. He's born in the year 37, okay? So when the revolt breaks out, he's barely 30 years old. He's appointed the commander of the Galilee. He fortifies the cities, and he's in the siege in Yodfat. And at that point is where he has a turning point in his understanding of what's going on. And he realizes, whether for personal gain or because he sees the bigger picture, that this revolt is not going to work. It's never going to work. It's never going to succeed. And as we're going to see, he manages to escape and to go over to the Roman side. And he basically spends the rest of the war trying to convince the Jews to give up. He, of course, is seen as a traitor. When the war is over, he relocates to Rome. He's under the patronage of Titus, and he writes his books in Greek for a non-Jewish audience, okay? That's important to understand. He's not writing it for the Jews. He's writing it to explain to the Romans that the Jews, despite their impression from the revolt, the Jews are not so terrible. It was just some crazy fanatics. That's who they are, okay? Now, out of all that, can we trust him? So first of all, he was an eyewitness, okay? Much of what he describes, he saw with his very own eyes, and he's writing it very soon after the events occur. And I always think that's important, because if he was writing blatant lies, people would know that. Does he include his own opinions? Does he include his own speeches? Of course he does. So do all ancient historians and some modern historians, right? No historians are truly objective. And certainly in ancient histories, you made up speeches wholesale. That was not a problem. But the stories that he tells, basically my approach to Josephus is he is believable in places where he doesn't need to tell a lie, right? Where it's not in his interest to necessarily tell a lie. Besides that, he's the best we've got, right? When you talk about the Bar Kokhba revolt, we wish we had a Josephus. We have only little fragmented accounts here and there, a little in the Gemara, a little in the Romans, some more in archaeology, whereas here we have a full and complete story. So we're going to have to take Josephus as he is. We talked about the underlying causes, but the immediate causes of the war, anti-Semitic acts that take place in Caesarea, okay, two different locations, Caesarea and Jerusalem. Anti-Semitic act in Caesarea, which provokes some riots and some attacks by the Jews, as well as theft from the Beit HaMikdash in Jerusalem, and these two things together make the storm break out. So we have these two sources in Josephus. Take a look on the left. On the next day, which was the seventh day of the week, i.e. Shabbat, when the Jews were crowding apace to their synagogue, a certain man of Caesarea of a seditious temper got an earthen vessel, set it with the bottom upward at the entrance of that synagogue, and sacrificed birds. Why was this so provoking? Unclear. I mean, he's clearly doing something that's against Shabbat, and there may have been some, you know, more local background to the story, but for whatever reason, this thing provoked the Jews to an incurable degree because their laws were affronted and the place was polluted. Whereupon the sober and moderate part of the Jews thought it proper to have recourse to their governors again, while the seditious part and such as were in the fervor of their youth were vehemently inflamed to flight. Okay, not so far away, around the same time, is the other piece of the story. As to the citizens of Jerusalem, though they took this matter very ill, yet did they restrain their passion. But Florus is the governor. He is very, very greedy. He takes whatever money he wants from the Mikdash. Florus acted as if he had been hired and blew up the war into a flame and sent some to take 17 talents out of the sacred treasure and pretended that Caesar wanted them. At this, the people were in confusion immediately and ran together to the temple with prodigious clamors and called upon Caesar by name and besought him to free them from the tyranny of Florus. So often, like it often happens in wars, everything is getting ready to boil under the surface, and it's some seemingly minor incidents that ignite the flame and that start the battles. What's the basic outline of the story? So like I said, we are dealing with the first year of the war, the first year and a half, okay? In 66, the Roman general Cestius Gallus marches on Jerusalem, and he is defeated. Now, this is something that gives the Jews great hope. People who had not necessarily joined the revolutionaries before, and realize how crazy this is, right? We're talking about little Judea against the entire Roman Empire. This is not a logical thing to do. On the other hand, Jews don't always act logically, and they're looking back at the story of Hanukkah, the few against the many, right? The righteous against the evil. But even people who are sitting on the fence see this defeat and they say, ah, well, maybe it really is going to work, right? And they start to join. And the Judean Provisional Government is formed. Now, one of the things we see in Josephus, and we see it in kind of obliquely in other sources as well, in the Gemara, there are way too many leaders, right? There are way too many cooks in the kitchen in this revolt, and the cooks do not like each other, and they fight against each other, and sometimes they kill each other. So you don't have one, it says provisional government, but there are a lot of small leaders, some of them in the Galilee, some of them in Jerusalem, who are not necessarily working together. Josephus is appointed the commander of the Galilee. Vespasian is sent to lead the Roman attacks. In the spring of 67, Yodfat is besieged. Josephus tells us 47 days of siege, and it falls in the month of Tammuz, right? In the heat of the summer. We're going to see that we know that for sure from a very chilling inscription discovered in Yodfat. Okay? In the fall, another few months later, the battle has moved on to the Golan. And by the fall, by the time of Sukkot, Gamla falls and the north is taken by the Romans. So the battles in the Galilee do not last very long. And by the end of 67, the Galilee belongs to the Romans and they are able to focus themselves on Jerusalem. Nero dies, the battle for succession is eventually won by Vespasian and Titus takes over as commander of the Roman forces. And of course, if we were to continue the story, right, do a part two, we would talk about the attacks and the siege of Jerusalem. But we are going to focus on the north. I apologize for the quality of this map, not so fabulous. But basically, we want to talk about, just point out where we are going, right? And again, here is Yodfat or Jotapata, as Josephus calls it, right? Squarely in the center, the Romans tend to control on the coast, Acco, Ptolemais, Caesarea, okay, also on the other side, Beit Sha'an, Scythopolis, but not in the center. That's where we have a lot of Jewish communities. Another thing about the Galilee, by the way, is we have, it's more homogeneous, at least when you're on the inside, right, mostly Jewish. However, a lot of different types of communities. You have very small communities. You have much larger towns like Tiberias, right? You have wealthy cities. You have poor cities. You really have a variety of different communities, okay? But we are going to start out in Yodfat, okay? Other places that are nearby, okay? Tzipori, Sepphoris, they are a very wealthy city that immediately surrenders to the Romans because why should we ask for trouble? Okay, Tiberias also surrenders to the Romans. Tarichaea, the Greek name for Migdal, where there's a very fierce and terrible battle and they eventually lose. But Yodfat is where a lot of the drama takes place and it is not a short story. It takes more than a month and a half. Okay, so what's unusual or special about Yodfat? So today, by the way, Yodfat is a small Jewish community in a beautiful, beautiful area. The Tell, the ancient part of the city, is outside of the modern community, and you can go and see it today. And archaeological excavations were done there. It was excavated by Moti Aviam in the 1990s. We know about Yodfat. We'll read about what Josephus says about it in a second. But according to the Mishnah, it's a walled city from the time of Joshua, meaning when we talk about cities that are keeping Shushan Purim instead of Purim, right? Our next holiday coming up. Yodfat is one of those cities. Archaeology shows remains that go back to the Hasmonean period. Okay, not exactly the time of Joshua, but maybe there was an earlier city somewhere else. It's one of the cities of the Mishmarot Kehuna, right? Where we know that the Kohanim moved Whether in the temple or afterwards. And in fact, we have a kina that we read on Tisha B'Av, right? Echa Yashva Chavatzelet HaSharon, which mentions each one of the 24 cities where the different groups of Kohanim lived. And Yodfat, of course, is one of them, right? Now, what does Josephus tell us about Yodfat? Yodfat, take a look up here. Yodfat is almost all of it built on a precipice, having on all other sides of it every way valleys immensely deep and steep, in so much as those who would look down would have their sight fail them before it reaches the bottom. It is only to be come on at the north side, where the utmost part of the city is built on the mountain, as it ends obliquely at a plain. This mountain Josephus had encompassed with a wall when he fortified the city, that its top might not be capable of seized upon by the enemies. The city is covered all round with other mountains, and can no way be seen till a man comes just upon it. And this was the strong situation of Yodfat. So Josephus comes, he's the commander here, he sees the natural advantages, and he also fortifies the city, builds a wall, okay? And he continues, right? Josephus talks about himself in the third person. Josephus thought it would be entirely wrong in him if he could make no contrivances in opposition to this, right? To the siege of the Romans that we're going to see in a minute. And to be for the city's preservation, he got together his workmen and ordered them to build the wall higher. Now, I brought you this particular picture, which doesn't look like much, but it's a drawing from the archaeological excavations. And what I wanted to show you about it is you can see this is the wall that Josephus is building, right? And it's covering up this furnace, right? Furnace, which was used for pottery or for charcoal or for various industrial things, on the edge of the town. You don't want it in the town. You want it on the edge of the town. But Josephus realizes that at this point in time, industry is less important than defense. And so he covers over the furnace with his wall. Okay, because the needs of the hour take precedence. Now, Yodfat, before we get to the story of the siege and the defense, Yodfat is a wealthy city. Okay, in the excavations that were discovered here, they found frescoes, right? Beautiful paintings on the walls, pottery, all kinds of things that show us that this is a wealthy city. It's also very clearly a Jewish city. Okay, there are mikvahs in the city. And it doesn't seem to have been a mixed city at all, but to be a wholly Jewish city. Now, the Romans come. This is the first battle for Vespasian, and it's a proving ground for him. He needs to succeed here. So he levels the road. He builds ramps. He uses battering rams, right? Now, like I said, the Parks Authority added in all these nice details, nice, terrible details, but interesting details to help us to picture what it might be like, right? And of course, they're at the bottom of the hill, to imagine being the Romans at the bottom of the hill, looking up at the heavily fortified city of Yodfat. It really is a great challenge for them. They also excavated and discovered not only the remains of the Jewish city, but the remains of what the Romans did. We found a lot of arrowheads, catapult stones, sandal nails, right? A lot of evidence of Roman soldiers and of Roman battles taking place here. Okay? And here are some of the arrowheads. The city is attacked, okay? And there's a siege for 47 days. The Jews have enough food. What they don't have enough of is water. Now, remember what we said, right? The city falls in the middle of Tammuz, right? That means the siege begins at the beginning of Sivan. We're talking about the summer months in a very dry area. There is not enough water. Here's a picture of one of the cisterns that was discovered in the ancient city, but there's not enough water. And the Romans are aware that there's not enough water, right? Which is a great psychological advantage for them. They know that the Jews are at the end of their water. What does Josephus tell the Jews to do? Okay. He says, take your laundry and hang it out in sight of the Romans. Make them see that you're doing your laundry. That way they'll think that we have more water than we really have. But eventually, nature wins. There's just not enough water. The Romans keep on hammering, keep on attacking, and finally they manage to break through. The Jews need to go into hiding. And one of the things that they discovered in Yodfat were a complex of hideout caves, right? An opening to three rooms on two different levels with pottery inside, and perhaps most importantly, with coins from the reign of Nero, meaning placing us exactly at this time period. And the Jews, who are not attacked by the Romans, go into the hideout caves, but there's only so long that you can hold out there, right? And here Josephus again tells us that on this day the Romans slew the multitude that appeared openly, but on the following days they searched the hiding places and fell upon those that were underground and in the caverns. Now, we think of hiding caves when we talk about the Bar Kokhba story, because in Bar Kokhba story, the Jews really did dig very extensive underground hiding places. We also hear about them mentioned from time to time in the rabbis, right? They talk about a machboah, a hiding place, right? And we even have crazy stories about babies being born and being exchanged because you couldn't see anything in the darkness. Or the Gemara talks about how if there is such a hiding cave in a town, then if the soldiers come into the town, you don't have to suspect that any of the women were raped, because we assume that they were able to get to the hiding cave. That's a very important halachic legal idea. So this is something that's part of the reality, unfortunately, much more so in Bar Kokhba, but in the time of the Great Revolt as well. And Josephus goes to hide out in one of these caves as well. All right. Now he goes to hide out, and he is with others from the city who have gone to hide out. He knows the Romans want him. They know he's the commander. They're after him. They want him to surrender. He wants to surrender. He knows that if he surrenders, things might turn out okay, but the fighters in Yodfat, they don't want to surrender, right? And we're going to hear an echo of this story in Gamla and later in Masada. They want to commit suicide. They want to go out in a blaze of glory. Josephus is not a go out in a blaze of glory kind of guy. He's a survival kind of guy. And he tries to convince them that this is a bad idea, that they should surrender to the Romans, that they should even give him to the Romans. They can commit suicide, but if he gives that, you give him to the Romans, things will be better. No dice. Nobody's listening to him. And finally, he convinces them, okay, we'll commit suicide, but we'll do it by lots. And he does it in a way, let's read what he says here. "And now," said he, "since it is resolved among you that you will die, let us commit our mutual deaths to determination by lot. He whom the lot falls to first, let him be killed by him that has the second lot. And thus fortune shall make its progress through us all, nor shall any of us perish by his own right hand, for it would be unfair if when the rest are gone, somebody should repent and save himself." Okay, so we're going to draw a lot. Number one kills number two kills number three, or whatever, you know what I mean, I'm saying that wrong. "This proposal appeared to them to be very just, and when he had prevailed with them to determine this matter by lots, he drew one of the lots for himself also. He who had the first lot laid his neck bare to him that had the next, as supposing that the general would die among them immediately, for they thought death, if Josephus might but die with them, was sweeter than life. Yet was he with another left to the last, whether we must say it happened by chance, or whether by the providence of God." Josephus rigs the lottery so that he is the second to last or the last, and he manages to convince the other guy. Everybody else is dead. He convinces the other guy that they shouldn't commit suicide and they should surrender to the Romans. And he writes about this in autobiography, how he does it, right? The mathematical trick, how he arranges it this way. He's very proud of it. And you might consider it reprehensible or not, but he manages to escape. He manages to get out to Vespasian, and he manages to get Vespasian to spare his life. And he tells him good things about what's going to happen, and you're going to become the emperor. If this story sounds familiar to you, we have a similar story with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in Jerusalem. Only Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai manages to get out, not to save his neck, but to save the Jewish people. Josephus gets out to save his neck. So the stories are very parallel. Who stole from who? Did they both happen? That's an interesting question, but we are going to go on. But I will just explain this picture for a moment, this very chilling picture. The story that Josephus tells is clearly something that happened, because we found many bones, including the skull, in the caves. Many bones were found in one of the cisterns. And we know that there really was, whether it was the Romans killing everybody or a suicide, Yodfat falls, and Josephus goes over to the Romans. Now, one of the things that was discovered in this recent archaeological excavation was a stone. Okay, this is a copy of it. It was a stone that had two pictures on it, and they really are very chilling pictures, right? This was copied on a sign, Yad Zikaron Lemigine Yotfat. This is a memorial to the defenders of Yotfat. And what are the two pictures that we have here? Okay, we have this, which is what we call a nefesh, right? It's basically what you put on top of a grave, okay? And so it symbolizes death, okay? And we have this crab. The crab is the symbol of the month, the zodiac sign of the month of Tammuz. So we died in Tammuz. This is somebody very desperate at the end who wants to leave some kind of record, and this is what he leaves. And this becomes for today the symbol of the site of Yodfat. I'll just say one more word about Yodfat. If you know a little, flash forward, fast forward to Zionist history, okay, the revisionist movement under Ze'ev Jabotinsky, right, and Beitar Jabotinsky writes the anthem for Beitar, where he talks about these classic examples of bravery in Jewish history, okay? Beitar, which is in the story of Bar Kokhba, Masada, and Yodfat, right? Because Yodfat fell, committed suicide rather than submit to the Romans. We are going to move on to Gamla, which is another very powerful story. So here we are in Gamla, okay, in the Golan, okay? Golan. Here's Ma'ale Gamla. So Gamla is right about here. Okay, really right over here. The Golan has a very, very rich Jewish life. Okay? Again, Gamla is another one of these ancient cities, also from the time of Yoshua, from the time of Joshua. Gamla is in the center south of the Golan. Golan had a rich Jewish life in Second Temple times and later. Then we have a long period where there are Jews not living there, and their Jewish life only restarts there after the Six-Day War. And that's also when we discover a lot of the amazing Jewish history of the Golan. We have really incredible discoveries here, many, many ancient synagogues and small communities. And Gamla is one of those communities. Gamla, if you're wondering about the strange name, right? Here's Josephus again. Gamla, in so much that it is like a camel in figure, a gamal, from whence it is so named. Okay, take a look at Gamla. It has a camel's hump. You can't go to Gamla without seeing this. It's very obvious. It's very clear. It's an unusual shape and location. It's not the easiest place on which to build a city. And take a look, and you can see, this is such a great picture, right? You can see the city built on the slope. Okay, we're going to explore it a little bit more closely, but here's the wall that was uncovered and a guard tower. Here's the synagogue, the Beit Knesset. We also have houses. It's built on this slope. Now, in some ways you say, well, why would you build in such a crazy place, right? But on the other hand, it's very fertile. There's a lot of water. It's not far from the Kinneret, so it's good for trade. It's very good for defense, right? You have this kind of an inaccessible place. There are springs here. This is a great place. So this is a Jewish community already from Hasmonean times. We're going to see coins that are found here from the Hasmonean king Alexander Yanai, or maybe even earlier than him, maybe even from John Hyrcanus. Right? So we're talking about second century, first century before the Common Era. The town of Gamla is already founded. Can't talk about Gamla without talking about the Nesher for a moment, because if you go to Gamla, you can see these magnificent, magnificent birds. This is a Nesher. Now, traditionally, if you grew up in the Jewish school in the diaspora, what is a Nesher? A Nesher is an eagle. No, a Nesher is not an eagle. A Nesher is a griffin vulture. Why did it get the name eagle? Because people don't like vultures. They say vultures, ugh, nasty birds, they eat carrion, but eagles, they are glorious and soaring. Really not true, okay? Vultures are a very important part of the ecosystem. If you didn't have somebody to eat carrion, you would have a lot of disease. And there really are few birds that are more majestic than a Nesher. And that's why we have in Tanakh, right? God says, I will carry you al kanfei nesharim, on the wings of the Nesher. Ka Nesher ya'ufu, right? Yeshayahu talks about the wings of the Nesher. And it really is an incredibly beautiful bird with an enormous wingspan, 2.5 meter wide wingspan. It can float on air currents for miles and miles. And you can go to Gamla and you can see the nesharim that have been set free there. They were on the verge of extinction. Now they're doing much better. But back to our story. Okay, so after the Six-Day War, it was understood that there was a lot of archaeology to be discovered in the Golan. So there was a survey that was done post 67. One of the leaders of the survey is this gentleman here, Shmayahu Gutman, really a legendary archaeologist, one of the first people to be involved with digging in Masada, discovering Masada, right? And he and one of his one of the people working with him, Yitzchak Igal, they're doing the survey and they come upon this mountain and they know the story from Josephus and they take a look and they say, "Whoa, this looks like a gamal. It really does. And it really fits with what Josephus says. And they're there and they're there with some students. And Shmayahu Gutman says, "Okay, we're going to go down the hill," right? They're looking at it from the top. If you've ever been to Gamla, you know that there's like a lookout point and then you walk down the hill to get there. It's quite a hike, but it's beautiful. And he says, "Okay, we're going to go. And whoever finds the first coin, you know, he's going to win the contest." And they get down the hill and really, literally within the first hour of being there, they find coins from the time of Alexander Yanai, which is what you're seeing down here, these coins. And they know there's going to be more than 6,000 coins that are eventually found in Gamla. So it's not so crazy that they found them, but they know that this is the right time period. And now they just have to make a very difficult decision, which is where to dig. They see the remains of the wall, okay? A more than 300 meter long wall. Where along that point do we dig? They choose to dig in the place that has the stones that look the nicest. It was a very good choice because that's where the Beit Knesset was found. That's where the ancient synagogue was found. We're going to see that in a minute. Just one more word, right? Take a look back at Gamla for a second. Imagine doing an archaeological excavation here, right? The road, you could take a road today that takes you all the way there. It did not exist then. And this is a very difficult, backbreaking kind of an excavation, but incredibly, incredibly rewarding. Shmayahu Gutman really felt that this was one of the pinnacles of his career. And they start to dig and they discover that besides our story of the Great Revolt, which we're going to come back to in a minute, Gamla is fascinating because it was a living Jewish town, okay? And we found a lot of that evidence of the town itself. So for example, we say a Jewish town, what does that mean? Well, first of all, it means mikvahs, all right? So we have two mikvahs that are here that were found. One is found by the synagogue. One is found by an olive press, meaning they're making their oil in purity. Okay, that's important to them. We found stone vessels, very much a sign of Jews in Second Temple times, because stone vessels are another example of doing things in purity. And something that's really very unusual that we found, we hear about it all over rabbinic literature, but to find it is really amazing. Gamla, and it might be the only place, I might be wrong, there might be also in Susia, but it's one of the few places where we have found this. Now you say, what's this big deal? It's a bunch of stones. Okay. This is an opening to an alleyway. Okay. What rabbinic literature calls a mavoi. Okay. This is the wall of the alleyway. This is a second wall next to it. And this is what we call a lechi. Okay. Anybody who worked through Erevin a few months ago may remember the endless discussions about putting up an extra beam at the entrance to an alleyway to enable carrying. And we do this today in our modern Erevin. I'm sure Rabbi Kelman can tell you about the Erevin Toronto and how it works, right? But we have very rarely found a real lechi, found pictures, found actual evidence that this was done and it wasn't just a halachic construct. So this is a lechi that was discovered in Gamla, and that's really an amazing thing to find. We also found that there are a lot of ways into the city. And that could be because we know that this area, Golan Babashan, there's a city of refuge here, right? In Ir Miklat. Maybe there's a lot of ways in because we want to make it easy for people to get in to the city or to get out of the city. In any case, there definitely is a lot of evidence that this is a Jewish city. And of course, we have the Beit Knesset, right? We have the synagogue. Synagogue is one of the earlier synagogues, right? First century before the Common Era. Today, we've discovered the synagogue in Migdal, but when this was discovered, this was one of the earliest synagogues to be found, not like in Masada or in Herodian, a synagogue that's like a temporary, just for a few years, built by the zealots, but this is a synagogue built by the community that lived here. Okay? It has the classic synagogue architecture, right, of that time, the benches around the side, the pillars in the center. Okay, we also have a mikveh right nearby. One of the things that's very interesting about the Gamla Synagogue is it's right next to the wall of the city. Remember, we said, where are they going to dig? And they decide to dig by these very nice stones. It's right in the wall of the city. And we have this question, when do synagogues begin, right? And Professor Yisrael Levine says, well, maybe it's not an event. It's a process. And maybe the place that was the important gathering place in First Temple times, the gates of the city, maybe that transitions slowly but surely to a structure which we call the synagogue. And here we have one that's literally by the gates of the city. So that's just an interesting suggestion. There's also a beautiful synagogue that we have found. Let's go back to our story of the Great Revolt. So the Romans come to Gamla. Okay, they have made their way through the Galilee and now they are in the Golan and they come. This is the last Galilee site to fall. So there are refugees here from other towns who have come here. Okay, and there, of course, is a wall. There is a tower, right? Guard towers to protect the city. And we found pieces of all of these. And the Romans do what they do best. They set up their catapults. Okay? Their attacks. There's a relentless assault. Over 1,500 catapult stones were found around the walls. And Gamla is fascinating also, similar to Yodfat, but different from Masada, where we have not just preparations for a battle, but we actually see evidence of the battle, right? We can see the arrowheads. We can see the catapult stones. They attack the city one time and fail. The second time they succeed. This is the breach that they make in the wall, okay? They're able to make a breach. And we also found this weapon, which we know is a weapon that the Romans use. See this on the right here, this fireman's hook, right? You hook it onto the wall and then you can use it to climb over the wall and you can get in. And we found evidence of Roman armor, right? Not just pieces of the battle, but the soldiers as well. And they finally break into the city. And what happens next? And here Josephus tells us what happens. And here Josephus is presumably not an eyewitness, but the story he tells is a fascinating story, right? Here are some of our arrowheads. Now he tells us that the Romans break in. And what happens next? Whereupon the people turned and fell upon their enemies who had attacked them and thrust them down to the lower parts. Remember, we're on a hill. And as they were distressed by the narrowness and difficulty of the place, slew them. And as the Romans could neither beat those back that were above them, nor escape the force of their own men that were forcing their way forward, right? They're trapped between the Jews attacking from the top, the Roman soldiers that are trying to get away. They were compelled to fly into their enemies' houses, which were low. But these houses being thus full of soldiers, right, the roofs of the houses, whose weight they could not bear, fell down suddenly. And when one house fell, it shook down a great many of those that were under it, as did those due to such as were under them. What's happening? You have a landslide. The Romans rush, try to get away from the Jewish soldiers, the Jewish rebels. They rush onto the roofs of the houses. The roofs of the houses collapse. By this means, a vast number of the Romans perished, for they were so terribly distressed that although they saw the houses subsiding, they were compelled to leap upon the tops of them. So that a great many were ground to powder by these ruins, and a great many of those that got from under them lost some of their limbs. But still a greater number were suffocated by the dust that arose from the ruins. The people of Gamla suppose this to be an assistance afforded them by God, right? This is a sign. We defeated the Romans. Everything's good. And without regarding what damage they suffered themselves, they pressed forward, thrust the enemies upon the top of their houses. And when they stumbled in the sharp and narrow streets and were perpetually falling down, they threw their stones or darts at them and slew them. Now, this is a bit of a strange idea, right? We can understand it based on the topography that we looked at, that they would have to climb onto the roofs. But we know, right? We know from reading rabbinic literature and even from looking at Arab houses today, roofs were meant to have people on top of them. That's a very classic use. People didn't have big houses and the roof was another room. You use the roof to dry your laundry. You use the roof to put your fruit out so that it would dry in the summertime. You use the roof as a place to sleep when it was too hot. You use the roof as a place to get some privacy. People used roofs all the time. They were created out of wood or out of thatch, and then with plaster on top. We have a tool called a ma'agela to cover it over with plaster, and they were supposed to be strong. So how did these roofs all fall in? And here I'm going to give you a very interesting suggestion from a colleague of mine, another guy named Huey Alman, and he says, read Josephus carefully, and it's very clear that the story is taking place on Sukkot. Right? He talks about when the Romans come, and they come in the month of Tishrei, and the story is taking place on Sukkot. The people of Gamla hardly have leisure to build themselves nice sukkahs, right? They're under attack from the Romans. They're being besieged, but they still have to fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah. So what do? They take off the plaster and the thatch on the roof of one of the rooms of their houses, and they put up schach. And the Romans, when they climb onto the roofs, they're not climbing onto real roofs. They're climbing onto sukkah roofs. And that's why the whole thing collapses on top of itself. It's a fascinating idea. Josephus kind of hints at it, but he doesn't really say it outright. Now, despite this success, the Romans storm back, and this time they are successful. And the Jews of Gamla, and this is why Gamla has gotten the name Masada of the North, the Jews of Gamla, according to Josephus, rather than surrender, they commit suicide by throwing themselves off the mountain into the valley. Again, according to Josephus. It's very clear that a battle took place. It's very clear that the Romans were there. The suicide, we have less proof for. We have no reason to think it didn't happen, but we have less proof for it. But I want to focus not on the suicide, but on what was the idea behind what Gamla was doing. Now, from the 6,200 coins that were found in Gamla, it's an amazing number, there are six coins that were found that were kind of unusual. They were clearly made at the site. They're homemade. They're very crude. They're not made well at all. Okay. And they have on one side kind of a chalice, a kiddush cup, whatever you want to call it, some kind of a ritual cup, similar to coins that we have from the Great Revolt from Jerusalem. And they say in a mixture, it's clearly an amateur doing this, a mixture of the old letters, the new letters, mirror writing, straight writing. But what do they say? Ligi'ulat Yerushalayim hakeh. Right, which we assume is Hakdosha, for the redemption of Holy Jerusalem. They are far, far away in the Galilee. They are not near Jerusalem at all. What is their battle? Their battle is for Jerusalem. They are fighting for Jerusalem. They are connected to Jerusalem. This whole story that's taking place in Gamla and Yodfat, all over the Galilee, is not just about them and about sovereignty, but it's about Jerusalem, and it's about their connection to the temple, and it's about their connection to Jerusalem. And this is an idea that we see not only in battle and in defeat, but also in life, right? Not so far away from Gamla, across the Kinneret in the town of Migdal, we have a synagogue that was discovered not so long ago. I don't remember if we spoke about it in these classes. I don't think we did. Migdal is an amazing, amazing site. It's also another early synagogue. It's being dug and paid for by Mexican Catholics because of the story of Mary Magdalene, who's from Migdal, okay, according to the New Testament. But they discovered, of course, a synagogue because Mary Magdalene is a Jew and Jesus is a Jew and all these people are Jews. But what's special about the synagogue, besides it being very early, is this amazing stone that was found in it. Now, this stone is very strange. It's kind of short. I would say it's like a foot and a half tall, 2 feet tall. It's not a table. It's too short to be a table. It's too uncomfortable to be a chair. We don't have any precedent of anything like it. But what you can see on it are these decorations, right? Decorations, particularly the menorah, right? But we also have these jugs, these pillars. We have on the other side rosettes. All of them are decorations that look like the temple, that remind us of the temple. And one suggestion of what this stone is it's a memorial, right? It's a memory. When you come to the synagogue, you might be far away in the Galilee, but you want to be thinking about and remembering Jerusalem. This is in the time that the temple is standing. It's still standing, but I want to have a connection to the temple because I can't get to the temple every week. So I want to come into my synagogue and I want to think about Jerusalem. So we definitely have a strong, strong connection between Judea and the Galilee, between Jerusalem and the Galilee. Once the Galilee falls, some of the commanders go to Jerusalem, take charge there, assassinate some of the commanders that are in Jerusalem. We have the siege. We have Vespasian being ultimately replaced by Titus, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai getting out of the city and going to Yavne. But ultimately, the city falls, the temple is destroyed in the year 70. We're going to still have the story of Masada, but the Romans already put out a coin, very, very famous coin, that says on it, Judea Capta, Judea has been captured, which of course, what's the iconography that's going on here? You have the Roman soldier, the proud, valiant Roman soldier standing next to the palm tree. Palm tree is a symbol of Judea. It's always been a symbol of the land of Israel. And who is sitting dejected and downtrodden in the shadow of the palm tree is the Judea Capta, is the woman who has been taken, who is captured. Obviously, man versus woman. The woman is very weak. The man is very strong. And this is clearly a sign of the fall of Judea, the victory of Rome. And the question is, who really wins, right? We have Rome values versus Jerusalem values, which the Gemara sets out very clearly the dichotomy between them. And I just brought you two pictures, right? A Beit Knesset, a synagogue, juxtaposed against the gladiators fighting the animals. The Romans may succeed in the short term, ultimately in the long term, although it's not at all clear to the Jews living through it, perhaps it is to Rabbi Akiva, but to most of the Jews living through it, it's not so clear. Jewish values succeed. And even the Romans, even in Roman times, Romans eventually are fed up with the Roman values, which value only male, wealthy property holders. Everybody else is insignificant, is meant to be used for those other people. And ultimately, many Romans turn to the values of Judaism. They become what are called God-fearers. They don't necessarily adopt all the Jewish practices, but when Christianity comes stronger, comes along, it is ripe for these people who want a system that has more values, that has more belief in the individual, that has a belief in an afterlife, and in the value of the things that you do, none of which is important in the Roman value system. And ultimately, Yehuda is not Capta anymore, but Liberata, Israel Liberata. This is a coin that was put out by the government coin authority in the 10-year anniversary to Israel's founding in 1958, right? Asor L'Chayrut Yisrael, at the 10 years to the freedom of Israel. And we have our same picture, but somewhat different. Our same palm tree in the middle, but this time both figures are standing. The man is not standing as a soldier, but as a proud farmer. The woman is holding her sheaves of wheat that she has because, you know, everything is thriving and is prospering. And today, both Yodfat and Gamla are thriving Jewish communities. And Gamla, in particular, falls in 67 and is rediscovered and refounded in the summer of 1967. So that's just a beautiful combination of events. So let's see what questions we have here. And if anybody else has questions. Okay. They were moving together before Nisuin, but after Kiddushin. Correct. I didn't go into the details. But again, not super modest. Weren't the 10 tribes exiled before this period of time? Remind me what we are talking about, because it was a while ago. Why are the 10 tribes connected here? You'll remind me, or you can write it.
Question,
okay, mathematics is known as the Josephus problem. What? Yes, the Josephus problem. I remember when I was a kid, I had a book that explained how they did it. Okay, the mistranslation was due to a European mistranslation where they did not have griffin vultures. I think it is originally from a mistranslation, but I think also vultures get bad press. They have bad PR, and eagles do not. Although the eagle is the symbol of the Roman Empire and of other unpleasant empires. So griffin vultures are better. Okay. The roof for Bathsheba's bath. Right. Roofs are used for everything. Exactly. Roman soldiers might wear very heavy armor. True. I'm not saying it's not possible. It just seems unlikely. If many didn't speak Hebrew, what language did they say their prayers? Many in the diaspora do not speak Hebrew today and say their prayers in Hebrew, correct? Although we do have fascinating discussions, particularly in Caesarea, right? Rabbi Abahu, who's the rabbi in Caesarea, somewhat later than our story, talks about, can you say Shema in the language that you know? Right? Can you say your prayers in other languages? And they did speak Aramaic. What does the SC stand for? It's a Roman, and I don't remember it off the top of my head. I can look it up for you. Was the stone found in the synagogue? Yes. Could it have been the Mizrach? They didn't really have such a concept at the time. In fact, they didn't even really have the directions at the time. It was more based on topography, and it wasn't always based on facing Jerusalem, but interesting suggestion. Hey, is there a museum in Gamla to see the coins? Okay, so there are two fascinating museums connected to these sites. Okay, if you go to the Golan, you can go to the one town in the Golan. There's only one. It's called Katsrin. And in Katsrin, there is the Golan Archaeological Museum, which does have a lot of stuff from Gamla. Okay? Some of the bigger things might be in the Israel Museum, but the Golan Archaeological Museum definitely focuses on the story of Gamla. It has a beautiful movie, actually, about it with Shmayahu Gutman in it. So that's one museum. The story of Yodfat is in another great museum, which is ridiculously hard to find, but it's a very interesting museum in Haifa University. There's a museum called the Hecht Museum, and they have a lot of the artifacts from Yodfat, and that's also another great place. Thank you, Kaddish in the Aramaic. The Rus may have been weakened by the catapults. Yes, perhaps. Okay, what does SC stand for? Senatus Consulto. Thank you, Shmuel Mortfield. Unlike gold and silver, Roman imperial bronze coin contain less than the full nominal value in metal. Their value is supported by the degree of the Senate. Oh, very nice, like paper money. Okay, very nice. What about Mr. Thaler and your question? Do you want to tell us more?
Was that the one on the 10 tribes that was sent to you privately? Because I don't see it on my chat.
Yes. This is Mr. Thaler. I thought the 10 tribes were exiled before the Roman period.
Yes, they were. What did I say that did not seem to fit with that?
But how were there Jews in such numbers fighting against the Romans?
Ah, okay. Why are there Jews living in the north, you're asking?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good question, right? So we know that we have, right, in the first temple period, the 10 tribes are exiled, and the Jews are not living in the northern part of the land. When they return after, in the return to Zion and Shivat Zion, right, they are basically in the area of Jerusalem, Judea, the tribe of Benjamin, slowly but surely, and this is part of the story of the Hasmoneans and their conquest, they spread out, right? They spread out, and we know we have communities in the Galilee definitely from the time of the Hasmoneans, perhaps even a little bit earlier. But you're right that there is a gap between the 10 tribes being exiled and those early years of Second Temple times. Does that make more sense?
Thank you.
Okay, we have another SC, Syria Koliak, the province of minting. Okay, I'm not a Roman coin or any coin expert, so I will go with Wikipedia. Yes, anybody else? Thank you.
All right,
you,
any questions? Okay, thank you. Yes, thank you. I want to thank you on behalf of everybody, on behalf of Termotion for agreed another wonderful series. Thank you, much appreciated.